This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Woody Allen famously quipped, "I don't believe in the afterlife, although I am bringing a change of underwear." That question, what happens to us after we die? It's an intriguing one. Science and humor writer Mary Roach provides an entertaining and thoughtful look at the question in her new book, Spook: Science Tackles the Afterlife. Roach takes an open-minded approach to the question. She describes the book as spirituality treated like crop science. Her curiosity led her to talk with all kinds of people, believers, scientists, scholars, and schemers. Listeners, I welcome your phone calls this afternoon for Mary Roach. Your questions and comments are invited. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Spook: Science Tackles the Afterlife is Mary Roach's second book. Her first was the bestseller Stiff: The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, both books published by W.W. Norton. Mary Roach, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on.
Sure. I wonder if everyone, no matter what he or she believes, has spent some time wondering about that question, what happens to us after we die, and imagining what an afterlife might be like.
I think that most people do. I wonder that myself also. I wonder about folks like my mother, who was a very devout Catholic and seemingly very comfortable with what the church set forth as what, you know, what is out there and what is waiting for us. And she seemed to be completely lacking in fear when toward the end of her life, and I didn't really ask her, but now I almost wish that I had, because I really wondered, was she immune to it? Did she really feel so confident that this is where she was going, or was she a little nervous about it, even though she'd been a good Catholic all her life? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I envy people with such solid faith that they are spared that.
Yeah. Did you
worry?
Yeah. Did you learn anything new about the appeal of the idea of an afterlife as a result of researching and writing Spook?
Anything new about the appeal?
Yeah, the appeal of it. You know, like, it
yes.
gave your mother great comfort.
Yes, I did. What was interesting was some of the cross-cultural. I mean, I didn't travel to a lot of different countries. I did spend time in India with a reincarnation researcher, and this is someone who investigates cases where children start talking about people or things that don't really fit the life that they're in, and then the community thinks, you know, gets together and thinks, let's see if we can figure out who in another village might have died around this time, the time the boy was born. And I actually went with this researcher with a little boy, and he met his supposed past life father, and we were there. You know, Dr. Rawat was trying to assess the case and see, you know, is this a strong case for reincarnation? It was not. But this moment when this little boy was introduced to this older man who had lost his son had been electrocuted in an accident, and the man took this little boy onto his lap, and there was such a sense of comfort that this provided for this man. He was obviously he very much believed this boy was his son born again, and it was this, and plus the two families had come together. It was like a huge party, and really and truly that belief had brought these two villages together, two families together, two people together, and it was a wonderful experience, and I began to feel that my presence with my notepad and Dr. Rawat with his video camera were completely irrelevant.
Yeah, it is in that way, in that setting there, it alleviated so much grief and it gave people their hope.
Right? Yes, absolutely. And I think that is a community in which almost everyone believes. There isn't any questioning that goes on. I think if you go to the urban areas in India, it's not something people believe so strongly in or so uniformly anyway. But in these communities, that is how you're raised, and that's what you're brought up to believe, and there isn't any reason to question it. And I thought these people are very fortunate for that.
Hmm.
You know.
Yeah. Another place your research took you for this book was the University of Virginia,
mm-hmm.
where computer equipment has been installed in an operating room to monitor near-death, out-of-body experiences. The equipment belongs to a professor of psychiatric medicine, Bruce Grayson, and he's been studying near-death, out-of-body experiences for very near three decades now. What does he hope that computer equipment might do in that operating room?
Well, I'll explain it a little bit. This is an operating room in which defibrillators are implanted in patients with dangerous heart arrhythmias. And part of that procedure entails stopping or scrambling the heartbeat. And essentially, these patients are clinically dead for a few seconds. And then the equipment is, they want to test the equipment and make sure it works and that it jumpstarts the heart. So they're a good population to study for near-death experiences because they have come about as near to death as you can come. So the computer then is, this is a laptop, and it's flat open such that the only way you could see what is on the screen is if you were up by the ceiling. You can't see it from underneath because it's flat open. And on the screen is a series of simple images, and they're randomly generated. And then when the patients come out of the operating room, they're interviewed. Dr. Grayson says, do you remember anything at all about your time in the operating room? And the hope is, and I say hope, I'm speaking for myself, I think more. I think he's just trying to see, is it possible for somebody, are they really up there? That's what they're trying to answer the question, because a near-death experience, it's an experience where frequently people describe seeing their resuscitation from above, and the debate has always been, well, is it a hallucination, or are mm-hmm. they actually up there? It's the consciousness leaving the body. So he's trying to get at that very specific point. Is it just something the brain manufactures when you're near death, or is it an actual trip that the consciousness is taking and going up by the ceiling? And he so far has not been, as far as I know, the last time I checked in with him, no one had yet a near-death experience. They're not that common. Not everybody who goes through this operation has one. The anesthesia that they're given also causes them to forget, unfortunately, so that even if they had one, they might not remember it. But it's interesting. I said, so Dr. Grayson, you have been studying this for 25 years or more. What do you believe? Do you mm-hmm. think the consciousness actually leaves the body when people have this experience? And he said, well, I wouldn't be surprised if we found out that it did, and I also wouldn't be surprised if we found out that it didn't. And I thought, wow, 25 years, and we still can't say yes or no.
Yeah.
What hope is there for me writing a book for a year and a half? But it's a fascinating. I just love that there are cardiologists involved in it, and it's a it's an academic setting. It's a major medical center, and they are taking it seriously and entertaining that possibility that the consciousness might do something that we can't figure out or explain.
Yeah. Well, what do the cardiologists there at the University of Virginia think of Grayson's study?
Well, there's a team of four who are involved in this particular project, but they declined to speak to me. I think that there's still enough of a stigma attached to quote-unquote paranormal investigations. Even though the near-death experience is a legitimate phenomenon, you see it written up in Lancet and the Journal of the American Medical Association, it still has a bit of the paranormal taint to it, and I think they were uncomfortable being associated with any kind of research in that area, although they felt it was legitimate. Obviously, they were putting their names to the paper. They didn't wish to have any publicity. So I think that tells you what they feel about it.
Yeah. It was interesting to know that there is a journal devoted to the topic, the Journal of Near-Death Studies. Is that a scholarly journal?
There are two or three journals devoted. Yes, they are. They are peer-reviewed journals that are set up in the standard journal format with an abstract and, the method and conclusions and all the different sections of any scholarly journal article. So yes, it is a journal. It's a legitimate journal. There's also an International Association of Near-Death Studies that has a journal. There's a tremendous amount of work that's been done in near-death experience.
How common are reports of near-death experiences that include an out-of-body experience?
I don't know the exact number. The core elements as they describe them are going down a tunnel and toward a light usually, and often a sense of euphoria that this light is love or is God, and there's some sense of communion with that. That's a very common experience. Also seeing loved ones and sometimes loved ones sending you back. It's interesting, though, although these are fairly universal elements, there are some cultural tweaks. For example, there was a description in one of these journals Grayson told me about of a Chinese gentleman who had a near-death experience, but the part where your loved one sends you back and says it's not your time, in his case, he said, there had been a clerical error, and I was sent back.
Well, tell us about Elizabeth Taylor's experience.
Oh, yes, Elizabeth Taylor. This is something I came across on the website of Celebrity Interviews. Yes, she encountered Mike Todd, and he sent her back, and I wondered whether that was for his sake or her sake. But anyway, the out-of-body part, that is an experience where someone feels they can, they're seeing from a perspective where they see, they're seeing their own body. They've left their body and they're floating or traveling up above the hospitals or up above the operating table. That's not as common as those core elements I mentioned, but it happens fairly often.
Yeah. What do people say about how that feels?
No one has ever said, I was scared to death, I thought I was going to fall, and from falling from that height, I would break my neck. It was always, it's an exhilarating, there's never very rarely a sense of fear. I think there was one study that said that of 700 near-death experiences, 105 were reported as a negative or scary thing. There were, the vast majority of them are overwhelmingly positive and quite life-changing for most people. Most people come away from these near-death experiences feeling that, A, they know where they're going when they die and they are no longer afraid, and B, feeling that their life is a treasure and they're going to make changes in their lives. So it's kind of a profound thing for people. And only rarely is it terrifying or negative.
Yeah, and those folks that have reported terrifying or negative feelings about it. Has anyone ever caught a glimpse of hell?
That's a great question. I wondered that too. And in fact, no. There was at one point a cardiologist who wrote a book about and describing people having seen grotesque figures, flames, people moaning and screaming. But then in his second book, he began saying, if you convert to Christianity, you can be sure you won't have this experience. So he kind of lost a lot of credibility there with this second book, where it seemed to be a tool for recruiting people to Christianity. So he's not, and no one else other than this particular man has ever described even an exceptionally warm climate. There's never been, people don't see hell. And it's interesting. One of the researchers, a cardiologist, Dr. Michael Sabom, included an appendix of of descriptions of the place people were going. In other words, you know, if this is heaven, if this is where we're going, well, what does it look like? And he actually had an appendix, and I describe in Spook that they seem to fall into one of two categories, either the weather report or the farm report, because they were either almost all of them fell into one of these categories, either clouds, blue sky, sun, a very sort of beautiful kind of archetypal heaven setting, and the other half were pasture, like a beautiful green pasture with trees and never any livestock for some reason, but just rolling, beautifully vivid green hills. So those were the two things people were reporting.
Yeah. How long do these experiences seem to last?
They seem to last a lot longer than they actually. I mean, they're often just, you know, a couple of seconds. The time, you know, where somebody's in the air as they're being thrown from a car before they land. I mean, but to the person, it seems to be a whole scenario unfolding that something happens with time, and that it kind of expands and seems to be, you know, it, very much, I guess, the way dreams seem to, in a very short span of time, encompass a lot of narrative.
Yeah. Enough time for a game of chess with a Grim Reaper, maybe, huh?
Yeah, possibly so.
Let's talk with a listener. We have a caller waiting to talk with us in DeWitt County. Our guest this afternoon, Mary Roach. Her latest book, Spook: Science Tackles the Afterlife. Caller on line 4, DeWitt County, good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. This is the second time I've spoken to you when you were on this station talking about STIF.
Oh, hello again.
A number of questions for you, and it was really enlightening. And I subsequently read the book, and my wife kept looking at me like, why are you looking so hard about a book about corpses? And it was just awfully hard to explain, but if this next book is half as entertaining, I look forward to reading it. So after the gushing is over, I had one comment in the movie The Waking Life about dreaming. I don't know if you've seen it or not, but I found it a really interesting concept that death would be like a dream where, you know, you just go on dreaming and you can, you know, go anywhere and do anything, and that's what the consciousness would be. And wonder if you ran across that notion in your study.
I did not. Waking Life is that, it's that animated.
Yes, it's a drawn over cell.
Yes, I did see that, yes.
Yeah.
And I didn't run across anyone, I think because of the parameters I'd put on the book, I was looking for researchers engaged or people engaged in pinning down the afterlife, actually finding some proof for it.
I see.
So that would be a tough one to prove. I think wasn't there a Ray Bradbury or somewhere a notion that our dreams are the real thing and that we are the product of someone else's dream or some, I don't know, but those things just completely turn my mind inside out.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's
but I do, yeah. That, it wouldn't surprise me at this point. Nothing would surprise me.
All right. Thank you.
Sure,
thanks for the call this afternoon. You know, the caller mentioned your earlier book, STIF, and, you know, I have to imagine that Spook is the afterlife of STIF.
Yeah, exactly.
But what led you to tackle STIF?
STIF grew out of a column I wrote for Salon.com, but which had to do with health, medicine, the human body. I wrote a weekly, every other week, a reported but funny column. And I guess it grew out of that, but it also grew out of my kind of overactive and easily bored sense of curiosity. I always wander out to the fringes of my subject matter. And, for example, when I was doing the column, the column I think that was the spark for STIF was about cadavers and how they are used in the crash test dummy industry. In the early days, they needed to calibrate the dummies, and they needed all this information about what certain amounts of impact do to certain parts of the body. And I found this. I had no idea that bodies were used for anything like this. I thought they were just dissected in anatomy labs, and it turned out there's this whole range of post-mortem careers out there and amazing things that dead bodies, dead people have done. And I just was fascinated by the fact that this whole universe existed. I'd never heard about it, and surely no one had written a book about it. And that was kind of where it all began. I just and then I started looking around to see what other bizarre and interesting and crucial things dead people have done. You know, other than the obvious ones like organ transplant and anatomy labs. So.
Well, this afternoon, before we started talking, there was an item on the newscast about a transplant of facial features.
I heard about that, yes.
Very interesting.
Yeah, and that was some. I remember I wanted, a couple of years back, hearing about that and wanting to report on it. Back then, they weren't talking about it much. They didn't really want a reporter coming. But I, of course, had a completely misinformed notion. I sort of imagined it like the Nicolas Cage movie where you would be giving somebody, you would take a face entirely off of one person and put it onto another, when in fact you're not. It's just the outer, you know, the skin and the muscle and the person's bone structure really determines what they look like. Although I guess there'd be some characteristics of the donor that would come along, but what an amazing
story.
And I hadn't realized, you know, if you take, say you took skin from a thigh and put it on someone's face, well, it doesn't have the musculature to make those fine movements, and it would look like a mask. You know, so this is a tremendous improvement for these folks.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I want to refer back to when you said that the time that these people have these experiences seemed like a few seconds. I myself personally once had a premonition and was sitting in the passenger seat of my car when I was a child, and I just moved over next to my father, and right about 2 seconds later, the whole side of the car came in.
Whoa.
yeah, and somebody hit us in the side. And another time, I fell off of a roof, and my point with that accident is it seemed like everything happened in slow motion when that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And another time, I fell off of a roof, and I thought, for a brief second, that, you know, my life flashed before my eyes, but it was also a slow motion moment too. And I wonder if you've heard of any correlation with people in accidents, maybe not a near death experience, but in accidents of that being a coincidence or a correlation or whatever.
I have heard that just anecdotally, people in car accidents or bicycle accidents, and they'll describe, you know, what is essentially 2 seconds, it seemed in there, and they had the time to go through this elaborate thought process and, you know, review of their life and all of these things that seemed that their consciousness was operating on some
different
mode
plane.
Of time that didn't correlate with clock time.
Yeah. Correct, yeah. That's what it felt like to me, and I always just wondered about that, if there was a correlation with people just surviving accidents, not near-death experiences, if that happens quite a bit.
Yes, I think it is quite common. There's a website called, that's fascinating. It's a website of scientists' paranormal experiences, and these are some of them skeptics, but who have had these kind of extraordinary transcendent experiences. It's called the Archive of Scientists' Transcendent Experiences, and I don't know exactly what the URL is. But you'll find some of these, particularly, you mentioned the premonition of, you know, moving over and then the car hitting. There's one on there that a man, some scientist, had this whole premonition of this whole crime happening in this alley, and this very, you know, elaborate description, and then it turned out to have been happening. It was much more remarkable than how I'm describing it, but, you know, and because these people are, you know, pedigreed scientists, I guess, I find it all the more just amazing that they're, you know, how do you explain these things? You know, these are people who are endowed with a lot of capacity for critical thought, and yet they're just blown away by these things.
Yeah, when I did that, and my dad looked at me and said, "What'd you move over for?" And I was like, "I just felt like I needed to move over."
Yeah.
Good thing I did.
Yeah, it almost seemed like you jumped ahead of time somehow for a second there.
Yeah, well, you know, I call that divine intervention myself.
Whatever it is, it's a good thing. You know?
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Science and humor writer Mary Roach, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Her latest book, Spook Science, tackles the afterlife. My name is Celeste Quinn, and let's talk with another listener now, a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi, yes. I was listening to a similar program, and they relayed a story of a mafia hitman, of all people, having a near-death experience. And it was kind of disturbing, because if you think anyone would go to hell, it'd be a mafia hitman, but yet he had the same kind of warm, fuzzy
I tell that story.
Do you really?
Maybe you heard me somewhere.
Were you on WGN a while back?
Where is it?
In Chicago.
Yeah.
So that's my question. Basically, is is there any evidence of a hell out there for folks?
There is not, in the classic sense of people getting a glimpse of a hot place with screaming and pain and devils. There has not been any documented evidence of that. Sometimes people describe a near-death experience as a negative overall experience, but the sense that the researchers, the description that was given to me by this researcher was that probably they're experiencing a similar thing, rushing down a tunnel towards an unknown place, and for them, the unknown factor was overwhelming or frightening. They didn't know what was happening to them, and so they interpreted it as a negative thing. The mafia hitman, had a very euphoric experience, according to this Dr. Grayson at the University of Virginia, who told me he was somebody he had interviewed and worked with. And he had had, although he's somebody who had lived his life not by the good word and had done a lot of quite evil things, nonetheless had this euphoric near-death experience. Seemed to just no justice in the end.
Apparently. Kind of disturbing, because I didn't realize how much of my moral basis is still kind of based on that old Christian idea. But they were talking about do you believe in the afterlife or not? And I think I'd have an easier time with atheism than thinking that no matter what you do here right now, you'll end up in a nice warm place.
It did kind of turn things a little upside down to hear that, because I wondered that. That was specifically my question for him. I said, Dr. Grayson, are there for people who've lived their life amorally or doing evil things, do they have negative near-death experiences? And he said no. So there you go.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call. I wonder if he turned his life around, though.
He did. In fact,
how about that?
He said, Dr. Grayson had this wonderful quote. He said afterward, I think the guy's name was Rocky. He said his girlfriend would complain to Dr. Grayson, Rocky just doesn't, he's working with young boys now. He doesn't care about money. He doesn't care about things that matter anymore.
Oh, dear. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Champaign on line two. Good afternoon.
Hi. Quick question on the expansion of time thing. I think it's pretty well established that humans have better memory for highly charged emotional events than for negative events or for neutral events, and that has obvious survival value. If you see a guy getting eaten by a tiger, it's scary, and you learn to stay away from tigers. But my main question today has to do with the religious aspect of this afterlife and how it's treated among researchers. You've mentioned that one researcher was lost credibility by writing a book saying if you are a Christian, then you won't have these terrible near-death experiences, you won't go to hell. And yet other researchers are trying to find after-death experiences in a hospital setting, in an operating room, which looks a whole lot to me like scientific proof of the soul. So it seems to me that you have to be very careful. You personally have to be very careful, and as do other serious researchers on this to avoid religion, yet it's highly religious. I wonder, for instance, if the people that have been the scientists who have been reporting these things are themselves highly religious. Did you specifically look at the religious leanings of the researchers that you talked with?
No, I didn't get the sense that they're highly religious, but I sometimes got the feeling that they had a bit of a spiritual bent, not specific to any organized religion, but mm-hmm. more of the, you know, what you might classify as New Age spirituality. A few of them, not the guy at the University of Virginia. I didn't get any sense that he's that way at all. But yes, there is. I did get a feeling that there is a bit of that leaning. Yeah, and I do think that that's. It was interesting, and this particular researcher, this is somebody at the University of Arizona. You know, he sees himself as neutral, inhabiting the middle ground, just as I do. To him, I was a raging skeptic. To me, he seemed to lack a bit of critical thought. So it's mm-hmm. it's interesting how people perceive themselves, and I think sometimes as these leanings creep in and people don't even realize it, I think that's a valid, very valid point.
Yeah, although these after-death experiences or near-death experiences, whatever caused them, may well be one of the primary reasons that humans have religion. That and explaining crops, mm-hmm. I suppose.
Yeah.
And so thank you very much for talking with me. Interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Next, we talk with a listener on line 3 in Bloomington, Illinois. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm wondering if there's how much cultural influence there is on some of these near-death experiences. And as an example, people who decades ago were reporting encounters with aliens from space, they would make drawings or guide an artist to draw what these aliens look like, and not surprisingly, a lot of them look like the Hollywood depictions of the time with the large head and the bulbous eyes and so forth. So I'm wondering if you have an opinion on the near-death experiences, how much influence there might be on the floating, viewing from above, and seeing a bright light and that sort of thing, all of which are described quite frequently in literature and so forth.
Right. It doesn't seem near-death experiences, because they've been, I mean, there's an entire international, there's a journal of international Association of Near-Death Studies. There's been a lot of cross-cultural work and comparisons of people's descriptions of near-death experience. And there seems to be some basic elements that are common to all different cultures, and even back before you could really attribute it to the media and the fact that everybody has TV and the Internet. So it seems to be a little immune to that criticism as compared to, say, the alien stuff.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Yep.
Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana. Line 1, hi.
Yeah, to pick up on the idea of different religious points of view, there was an article back in January by In Reason that had made a statement that I'd like to ask you about in terms of Jews and the idea of an afterlife. To quote the article, it says, "Even Jews who traditionally have not had any scriptural basis for believing in an afterlife have begun acquiring it as a sort of contact high. The General Social Survey, conducted annually by the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago, found in the 1970s that a mere 19% of American Jews confessed a belief in the afterlife. In the 1990s, that proportion rose to an astonishing 56%, unquote. And I'm not particularly interested in the Jewish experience, unless you want to talk about that, but I was just curious if you'd heard about that, and whether other groups had shown this sudden, rather large increase in belief in the afterlife. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
I am not aware of that. That's quite a jump, and I don't really know what to attribute that to. Not sure. I mean, I would guess that perhaps it's all along been a little closer to 56%, and that it's a change in people feeling a little more comfortable stepping outside the traditional confines of what the religion says. And I think that the number of people who do believe both in God and an afterlife is amazingly high, and I think it probably always has been. And I don't know. I have no fact or change that I could point to explain that leap.
Interesting question, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe we could take up a question that you take up early in Spook, and that is the question of the soul. When did people begin theorizing about the soul?
Since I'm kind of looking at people trying to prove it or pin it down, some of the early philosopher anatomists actually went inside cadavers and would look for it. Descartes got very involved in trying to figure out how the human machine works, including, you know, where is the personality, the self, the control panel, the soul, if you will. And he actually spent time, he looked in, he had a bunch of cow heads at one point, and he was systematically going through the brain trying to find a structure that might correspond to his idea of the soul, or sort of where everything comes together and where everything is directed. And he had this one description of he had this, you know, this whole room full of heads and brains, and he describes showing guests this room and saying, "These are my books." And you could just imagine the dinner guests kind of saying, "Okay, Renee, gotta go." But anyway, it started a literal search, and very quickly became clear that the brain was the place to be looking, because, you know, you just somebody's kicked in the head by a horse and their brain is injured, their personality changes. So very early on, people began looking to the brain, and, you know, as opposed to the heart or even the liver or the stomach, which some very early civilizations thought the soul was located in. And so then from there, the brain became, there's this whole period of mapping the brain, and then the whole notion of a single entity called a soul that would be the one thing that was sort of running the human body and person, that kind of faded away, because it became clear, okay, language is over here in this part of the brain. This is the mathematical portion of the brain. Here's the memory. And some of them took it to the extreme, like Franz Gall, who had like 21 specific, you know, there was the organ for acquiring goods and stockpiling food. I mean, he had, like, the portions of the brain were, you know, there were 25 of them or something. So that's when sort of it moved into the realm of faith and religion and philosophy, and the anatomy folks kind of left it behind. And science moved on to, you know, the brain and consciousness, and the idea of the soul was not taken up by science again until we had folks like Duncan MacDougall, who was this man who tried to weigh the soul. Mm-hmm. He was a doctor. And so there have been, you know, pockets of renewed interest in trying to scientifically locate or prove that the soul has substance or can be weighed.
Yeah. In that chapter on you know, trying to weigh consciousness or the soul, there's a very interesting fellow by the name of, I don't know if it's Jerry or Gary.
Jerry
Nahum.
Yes.
And he's not a religious man, but he's very interested in this question, and he approached the Catholic Church to get some funding for his research. Tell us about him.
Yes. He's a professor, or he was at the time a professor at Duke University. Actually, not a. He has a background in quantum mechanics and consciousness theory, from Yale, but he's now, he's actually a professor of gynecology and obstetrics, but this has remained his passion. And he's, I was interested in him specifically because he has a proposal to build a system that would, if everything went right, be able to prove or disprove the persistence of consciousness energy at death. And he has, I mean, it would take some explaining to do here, but it's a fairly elegant and simple in quantum mechanics terms, which isn't all that simple, system that he has. And he says he could do it for about $100,000. And he tells the story of approaching the Catholic Church. And you know, he went back for a couple of meetings. And he said, you know, I guess it was sort of naive of me to think that they might want to know this, because, in fact, the Catholic Church already knows. They don't need somebody from the outside telling them, yes, there is or is not a soul, and the soul, and it carries on at death. He said they know, and they really don't want anybody mucking around in this. And they, in fact, tried to. He's Jewish, and he said they tried to convert him. They tried to convince him not to do the project, and also to consider converting. So he's still trying to get funding, as far as I know.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Chicago, line 4. Go ahead.
Thank you. Have you had any general inquiry into Edgar Cayce's group? I believe it's called ARE, Association of Research and Enlightenment, or Theosophical Society, about some general observations that they may have? And I have another question.
No, I did not work with them at all, no. Didn't do any research on their projects, no.
Oh, because I think they've had extensive views among those matters. Having mentioned India, did you get a chance to personally inquire of any so-called swamis or gurus and so forth about their views on things?
No, just because I was trying to stick to folks who were engaged in trying to prove or gather evidence. So I had to limit this somehow, because this whole subject of the afterlife is so huge. It would be a 200-volume set. Really trying to, you know, cover all the different theories, beliefs, cross-culturally, and it would be overwhelming. Well, so I had these parameters that I was, you know, really...
Oh, well, you mentioned Elizabeth Taylor. How about Shirley MacLaine?
Oh, well, yes, yeah, she definitely has very strong views on all of this. I did not speak to Shirley, though. Elizabeth Taylor, I had just come across a quote of hers on somebody had gathered up celebrity near-death experiences and describe them.
Well, one other point along the lines that we're talking about, I believe next Thursday on ABC Network, they're having a program on heaven with a Dalai Lama and other notable people, so that might be an interesting area to expand upon the work you were doing.
Yeah.
So that's, I believe, next Thursday evening.
Next Thursday. Well, thank you.
And one general comment, an anecdote about heaven and hell. It seems that some people said, gee, I'd like to see what hell is like, what we've been living on earth has been like, heaven or hell, depending on how things are for you. But is there any way I can experience heaven or hell? The person said, well, we'll get you a little look. So they were able to observe the conditions in hell for us, and there were these beautiful pastoral rolling fields and that, and off in the distance there were some huge parties going on, and they looked, and there were these banquet tables with people sitting there trying to eat, and the only way they could eat was by using these long utensils, which were so awkward you couldn't pick them up and feed yourself. He said, wow, that's really hell when you can't even eat. And so they said, what's heaven like? Well, they looked into heaven, and there was the same rolling pastoral fields and that, and there's the same situation where the people are sitting eating, except instead of feeding themselves with these long utensils, they were feeding each other.
Hmm.
So there's a little taste of
it.
Sharing. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, we've got to wrap up here, and before we go, I've got to ask you this question. Mary, you're standing there at those famous pearly gates, and Peter says, not to worry, come on in. And he says, well, wait a minute, though. Before you step in, is there anything special you like? We can make it happen. What would you ask for?
Free parking and jeans that make my butt look good. And... The mangoes are always perfectly ripe. and, of course, peace and happiness and love.
Yeah, there you go. What's the next project for you?
Well, the next project is, I'm not really giving away the topic quite yet, but I will say it's in keeping with my usual attention deficit goofball approach. But there are no dead people, no cadavers, no spirits. I'm moving away from that realm.
Okay.
But it's a humdinger. It's fun.
Well, keep up the quirky good work.
Thank you.
Mary Roach has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Spook: Science Tackles the Afterlife. She's also the author of Stiff: The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, and we'll look forward to her next effort. Both Spook and Stiff, published by Norton. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you much, Celeste. From the board this afternoon, futures in the bean pit finished the day higher, up about 4 cents, taking back most of losses from yesterday. The corn following suit in the nearby is at least up a penny and a quarter. The far deferred December was down a quarter of a cent, and the nearby wheat contract was up 3.5 cents today. In fact, that December contract at the Chicago Board of Trade for the soft red winter wheat had a high of 305, a low at 295.5, and a settlement price today at $3.04, up 3.5 cents. March contract up 4 at 320 and 3 quarters, the high 21 and 3 quarters, the low at $3.11 and 1 quarter. May futures in the wheat pit, 330 the high, the low at 320 and a half. The settlement price at the CBOT for the Chicago wheat, 329 and a half. They were up 4 cents. And July futures, 339 the high, the low at 329 and a quarter. Settlement price at 338 and 3 quarters, up 4 and a quarter on the day. September futures, 347 the high, the low at 38 and a half, and a settlement price at $3.46 and a half, up 3.5 cents. December corn futures now 187 and three quarters the high, up a penny and a quarter for the day, 186 and a half the low. Settlement price close to that high, 1.25 higher at 187 and one half in the December corn for this year. March futures 202 high, low at $2.75, holding above $2 at 201 and three quarters. A settlement price up a penny and a quarter, and the May futures 210 and three quarters the high, the low at 209 and a quarter. Settlement price 210, and they were up 3 quarters. July futures 218 and 3 quarters the high, the low at 217 and a half. A settlement price at 218, they were up a half. And September futures unchanged today, 227 and a half the high, the low at 226 and a quarter. Settlement price at 226 and 3 quarters unchanged. December futures for next year down a quarter, 239 and a quarter the high, the low at 37 and a half. And a settlement price for the red December corn, 237 and three quarters, down one quarter. December oats, 186 the high, the low at 181. Settlement price there at $1.85, up 3.5 cents. The March futures down 3.25. That's right, they were down 3.25 in the March, but the December were up 3.5. 181 and a quarter, the settlement price for that March contract, down 3.25. Soy complex now, soybean futures. March contract, rather January contract, 561 and a half the high, the low at 552 and a half, a settlement price at $5.58. They were up 4 for the day. March futures at 569 high, low at 560. Settlement price out of that 9 cent trading range at $5.66 and a quarter, up 4.75 for the day. May futures 574 and a half the high, the low at 66. Settlement price at $5.71 and a quarter for the May beans. They were up 4. July futures 580 and a half the high, the low at 571 and a half. Settlement price at 576 and a half, up 3.5 cents. In the August contract, 581 the high, the low at 75. Settlement price at $5.79. They were up 4 for the day. September soybeans 583 the high, the low at 576. Settlement price there at $5.80, up 3.5. In November contract, a 587 and a half high, low at 580 and a half. Settlement price 586 and a half. They were up 4. December bean mule futures 174.50 the high, the low at 171.20. Settlement price at 171.80, up $1.50. And the January's a 174.70 high, low at 171.30. Settlement price at 172.10. They were up 1.30 for the day. December bean oil 21.05 the high, the low at 20.80. Settlement price at 21.05. They were a dime higher. And January futures were up 12. 21.30 the high, the low at 21. January bean oil 21.29. Their settlement price once again 12 higher for the day. That's a look at the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, on the Merc, livestock contracts, for the most part, finished higher today.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri-Energy in Palestine, Illinois, producing a renewable fuel with corn bought directly from the farmer. More information at 800-586-2321 or online at lincolnlandagrienergy.com.
January feeder cattle, today's high 117 even, the low 116.47 and a half, the settlement 116.90, that down 30. March 115.40, the high 114.57 and a half, the low 115.32 and a half, the settlement, that down 12 and a half. April 114.10, the high 112.65, the low. April feeder cattle finishing at 113.72 and a half, that up 17 and a half. December live cattle, 93.50, the high 92.65, the low 93.45, the settlement, that up 60. February, 95.75, the high 94.80, the low 95.72.5, the settlement, that up 55. December lean hogs, 62.55, the high 61.90, the low 62.50, the settlement, that up 15. February, 67.50, the high 66.70, the low 67.35, the settlement, that up 52.5. April, 69.80, the high, 68.85, the low, 69.77 and a half, the settlement, that up 95. May, 70.60, the high, 70.05, the low, 70.60, the settlement, that was up 40 cents, that contract up 40. And February bellies, today's high, 88.55, the low, 86.52 and a half, the settlement, 88.25, that up 75. The Dow is off 43 points at 10,845. The NASDAQ up 1 at 2234. The S&P 500 down 5 at 1253.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Henry Frayne, our technical director this afternoon, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. 1 minute before 2 o'clock Central Time, 31 degrees in Urbana. Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon in northeastern Illinois and in northern and east central Indiana, mostly cloudy. Elsewhere, partly to mostly sunny. Highs ranging from 29 in northwestern Illinois to 43 in the far south. Tonight in northern and central Illinois, becoming cloudy with light snow arriving overnight. In southern Illinois, partly to mostly cloudy. In Indiana, partly cloudy early, then increasing cloudiness overnight. Lows ranging from 22 in northwestern Illinois to near 30 in the south. Tomorrow in northern and central Illinois, cloudy with light snow during the morning, mostly cloudy during the afternoon. In northern, central, and southeastern Indiana, cloudy with some light snow. In southern Illinois and southwestern Indiana, partly sunny tomorrow. Highs ranging from 28 in northwestern Illinois to 45 in the far south. Now let's take a look